But be on your guard, and do not try to understand and judge the Divine Mother by your little earthly mind that loves to subject even the things that are beyond it to its own norms and standards, its narrow reasonings and erring impressions, its bottomless aggressive ignorance, and its petty self-confident knowledge. The human mind, shut in the prison of its half-lit obscurity, cannot follow the many-sided freedom of the steps of the divine Shakti. The rapidity and complexity of her vision and action outrun its stumbling comprehension. The measures of her movement are not its measures. Bewildered by the swift alternation of her many different personalities, her making of rhythms and her breaking of rhythms, her accelerations of speed and her retardations, her varied ways of dealing with the problem of one and of another, her taking up and dropping now of this line and now of that one, and her gathering of them together, it will not recognize the way of the Supreme Power when it is circling and sweeping upwards through the maze of the ignorance to a supernal light. Open rather your soul to her, and be content to feel her with the psychic nature, and see her with the psychic vision that alone make a straight response to the truth. Then the Mother herself will enlighten by their psychic elements your mind and heart and life and physical consciousness and reveal to them too her ways and her nature. Avoid also the error of the ignorant mind's demand on the divine power to act always according to our crude surface notions of omniscience and omnipotence. For our mind clamors to be impressed at every turn by miraculous power and easy success and dazzling splendor. Otherwise, it cannot believe that here is the divine. The Mother is dealing with the ignorance in the fields of the ignorance. She has descended there and is not all above. Partly she veils, and partly she unveils her knowledge and her power, often holds them back from her instruments and personalities, and follows, that she may transform them, the way of the seeking mind, the way of the aspiring psychic, the way of the battling vital, the way of the imprisoned and suffering physical nature. There are conditions that have been laid down by a supreme will. There are many tangled knots that have to be loosened and cannot be cut abruptly asunder. The Asura and Rakshasa hold this evolving earthly nature and have to be met and conquered on their own terms, in their own long-conquered fief and province. The human in us has to be led and prepared to transcend its limits, and is too weak and obscure to be lifted up suddenly to a form far beyond it. The divine consciousness and force are there, and do at each moment the thing that is needed in the conditions of the labor. Take always the step that is decreed, and shape in the midst of imperfection the perfection that is to come. But only when the supermind has descended in you can she deal directly as the supramental Shakti with supramental natures. If you follow your mind, it will not recognize the Mother even when she is manifest before you. Follow your soul and not your mind, your soul that answers to the truth, not your mind that leaps at appearances. Trust the divine power, and she will free the godlike elements in you and shape all into an expression of divine nature. The supramental change is a thing decreed and inevitable in the evolution of the earth consciousness, for its upward ascent is not ended, and mind is not its last summit. But that the change may arrive, take form, and endure, there is needed the call from below with a will to recognize and not deny the light when it comes. And there is needed the sanction of the Supreme from above. The power that mediates between the sanction and the call is the presence and power of the Divine Mother. The Mother's power, and not any human endeavor and tapasya, can alone rend the lid and tear the covering and shape the vessel and bring down into this world of obscurity and falsehood and death and suffering truth and light and life divine and the immortals Ananda. It is perhaps of interest that today, the 2nd of December, 2018, we bring to a conclusion our reading of Sri Aurobindo's book, The Mother, with these last paragraphs in the 6th chapter. 2nd of December, which is when they have the final function of the calendar year for the Sri Aurobindo International Center of Education. Whereupon, all that the students imbibe during the year comes to a full expression through the physical being in front of the entire community. So consciousness brought into direct contact with matter so as to change it, to reshape, to step towards transformation. Not simply personally, but collectively, in part of a community, seen, emblematic, within the larger human race, representing the cosmos. So we salute all those in Pondicherry, in the Sri Aurobindo Ashram today, who have participated in that 2nd December occasion, which Mother established herself in the school that she brought into being. So let's go back and look at these closing paragraphs. But be on your guard, and do not try to understand and judge the Divine Mother by your little earthly mind. Well, I would say that that runs the gamut of the human mind, even up into the philosopher's wide vision. We are speaking here of the Divine Mother, who is supra-rational by definition. Her source is in that which is unknown. The energy, the consciousness that brings that unknown into real expression as being, as power, as conscious power, as a play of Ananda, is transcendent to the mind. The mind can barely perceive that it is there. You remember in the Kena Upanishad, when Indra, who represents the divine mind, the mind at its most vast, tries to approach the figure of what that mystery is, then it vanishes before his eyes. It is symbolic of the fact that the mind cannot know directly what that is. But there, in that supreme ether, he sees a figure of the goddess of the mountain, and approaches her and says, "Who was that being that I saw and could not know?" And she says, "That is the Brahman, that is the divine, whom you have to know, whom you drew the energy of victory from." And so Indra, who still could not know, was the wisest of the gods because he came closest to that. So even the cosmic functionaries, the powers that govern the cosmos, cannot know her ultimately. At the zenith of the mind's climb, there remains a mystery beyond, and that is the divine Shakti. So, here in this earth, Sri Aurobindo is saying directly to his disciples, do not judge her. You have only a mind. She is the one working out this riddle here. So complicated is it. She had to work in each individual according to the nature of that individual, so all couldn't get the same answer. When they began to compare the answers to the questions that they got from the mother, they were jealous. One person got a better answer than the other. It was the right answer for each, but they couldn't see it with that kind of parity. They couldn't believe that she wasn't playing favorites. But she wasn't. She was watching the Yoga Shakti as it descended and finding where it met resistance, and sometimes having to back that force out of there and look for another channel inside the individual to put the pressure there for conscious change. Always looking for a way to make an advance and then to consolidate that advance, sometimes having to back up and allow assimilation to occur before moving forward again. And what she needed from us was our active, conscious participation. And the question is, do we give it? When we practice yoga, do we really give it? Or do we sit like this with our hands out waiting to receive? But that gesture of reception is really a gesture of grasping, because we want what we want and we're not receiving what is given. So this supreme power, noted in the Devi Mahatmyam, noted in other scriptures as Adya Shakti, the original power of the divine. It is she who is carving out the path of evolution in us so that we can stand and be part of the vanguard as it moves forward, allowing the whole of the cosmos to be drawn ahead. So the individual and the community of aspirants working together can effectuate a change that will have a cosmic impact. He notes here that if you open your soul, relying not on the mind, but on the openness of your soul, and he means that quite literally, then the mother will bring light into those elements of your nature which are connected to the psychic. And therefore, reveal an impact, a changeful impact, upon your instrument, mind, life, and body. So, externally, superficial mind, externalizing vital, the more superficial aspects of the body have behind them subliminal reaches. The inner mind, the inner life, the subtle physical support all the external, That is the real ground of the being. But they have each of these subliminal regions of our personal nature a connection to the indwelling soul behind, and the psychic elements of the inner mind, the psychic element of the inner vital, the psychicized, subtle physical being, become unified and become, in a sense, a part of the felicity and the immortality of the soul, which has it native to itself, so that they are carried forward. They begin to become the points, the apertures through which this golden light of a changing consciousness, as the truth descends and empowers the nature, comes into the soul and into the nature through these psychicized elements and pushes outward and pushes outward. No, you won't feel the change in the outer nature first, but you will feel it finally. First you feel this surcharge of this power, this bliss of the Divine Mother, forcing its way into your being and bringing rapture to you. Ultimately, it comes like that, from inside out. So, our difficulties. Don't impose upon her, upon the Yoga Shakti, whether she's in the physical frame in front of you as the mother in the Sri Aurobindo Ashram or as that Divine Mother transcendent above. Don't impose the demand that show me your power that I may worship you. He writes, partly she veils, and partly she unveils her knowledge and her power. Often holds them back from her instruments and personalities, and follows that she may transform them, the way of the seeking mind, the way of the aspiring psychic, the way of the battling vital, the way of the imprisoned and suffering physical nature. He writes about our mother in the Sri Aurobindo Ashram here, that to make this pathway possible for the human, she has to accept in a real way the conditions of the ignorance. Sri Aurobindo writes about this in other letters. You'll find them in Letters on Yoga, where he describes that he and she have been through so much of this, taking on the actual burden. What is it like to fight through the obscurity of ignorance? What is it like to battle through physical illness? What is it like to battle through the claims of sexual desire, or desire for food, or whatever it might be that so tangles our feet in the paths of our progress? What is it? They had to go through it, and she, as he said, had to go through it 10 times more than he did. But they take it up so that there can be a real solution. Take up the actual human life as we find it, to demonstrate that it can be possible, it can be done. All these tangled knots, these granthis, as the Hatha Yoga described them singularly, that we exist studded along the axis of the spinal column in the chakras, you know, those are emblematic of knots where forces get tied up and don't get to speak well through our nature. But they can be untangled. They don't have to be cut. They can be gradually loosened and made clear and straight so that the divine force can move fluently through us. That is a matter that takes time to do. And in the doing of it, we have to overcome not simply the general gravid condition of the world, but also the active hostility of powers that are behind the scene, the Asura, the Rakshasa. The Asura is the mentalized, vital, anti-divine being, and the Rakshasa is the anti-divine being who occupies the field of the middle vital. These are constantly at war with us, trying to trip us up, seduce us, stall us, delay us by any means possible, so that they don't have to give up their darkness to an incoming light. So this is a battle that goes on behind the scene, but is part of what we have to deal with. No need to draw particular attention to it. They'll glory in the attention anyway. So, the truth is that the Chit Shakti, the divine consciousness and force, will affect the change that is needed step by step if we are receptive to her. But she can't do it all at once. It has to be done gradually. And the supramental will not come down in one fell swoop into anyone until that person, that being, the community that supports and surrounds that being are ready for it. In the meantime, follow not your mind, follow the soul. Live from inside, more from the soul each day, less and less from the mind, from the ego, from the point of division. Live from the force that unifies. This last paragraph is a supreme statement. The supramental change is a thing decreed and inevitable in the evolution of the earth consciousness. In other words, this will eventuate in a new range of evolutionary possibility. There will be a transcendence beyond the mind into the truth consciousness. This will be claimed by the earth. The earth demands it. If the human will not ask for it and reshape its being to house this truth consciousness, another being will come and replace the human. It will be done. But whoever it is that affects it, the things that are necessary, the call from below that recognizes and accepts the light, and the sanction of the Supreme from above. You remember, back to the first chapter, the call and the grace. There are two powers that alone can affect in their conjunction the great and difficult thing which is the aim of our endeavor. A fixed and unfailing aspiration that calls from below, and a supreme grace from above that answers. Here, in the last paragraph, he returns to that. What mediates between the call and the sanction is the power in the presence of the Divine Mother. Here, she is the Mahashakti, ready to transcend herself from the overmental Mahashakti into the supramental Mahashakti. And then he concludes, the mother's power and not any human endeavor in tapasya. The mother's power. The rash sadhaks who were part of the original ashram and who left because they felt that they could do it more quickly without the interference of Mother and Sri Aurobindo, that they could affect the supramental change, and presto changeo, transform the world, wandered away to achieve that, and were never seen again. They failed. It is she that will effectuate that work. The mother's power and not any human endeavor in tapasya. And what is tapasya? Tapasya is a great force. It is an effortful practice based upon intensification, tapas, heat, builds. The harder and harder you concentrate, the greater and greater the fire of your tapas. But however mighty the human individual is, working within the province of mind, life, and body, cannot bring by that demand the supramental light to this earth. One might climb to it in consciousness, but the question is, can we return from that experience? Can we capture that sublimating power and massage it into the material of the earth? Can alone rend the lid, that golden lid in the Isha Upanishad, 15th verse, which separates that truth world from this world. Can one rend that lid? Tear the covering. In other words, penetrate it and shape the vessel. That's us. That's the Adhara, mind, life, and body complex. And bring down into this world of obscurity and falsehood and death and suffering. Truth and light and life divine and the immortals, Ananda. This, she felt, was achieved in 1956 on the 29th of February, when with one blow, that lid was shattered and came rushing down into the earth, the supramental descent, a manifestation of the supramental that established itself in the cosmos, not in her body, but in the very depths of the cosmos, all the way into the inconscient. So, that having happened, there is a bridgeway, there is an invisible channel linking the transcendence of what the mother is above to what she is at the base of the cosmos, because all is she. All is she. And what does she bring down there? But her truth, Sat, light and life divine, Chit, and the immortals, Ananda. Sat, Chit, Ananda. The supernal above becomes present here. So I think that in the first chapter we saw a message on the mother's birthday in 1927, shortly after the ashram was founded, establishing the need for the call and the grace, a surrender to truth, a call for an actual practice of surrender, that this is the focus of the sadhana, to surrender to truth. In the second chapter we saw in her letter to Motilal Mehta, his letter to Motilal Mehta, the insistence on aspiration, rejection, and surrender. An aspiration to the truth, a rejection of what stands in the way, and a surrender to the power when it descends. In the third chapter, letter to Poonam Chand, grace, and then faith, sincerity, and surrender. So you can see the active word that appears again and again and again is to surrender to the truth, to yield, not to battle, not to egoistically think you're going to do it, but to perceive and be receptive to this truth as it descends. In the fourth chapter, another letter to Poonam Chand, here's a focus on gathering money force and converting it without desire into a means of enabling the divine work to get established upon earth. In the fifth chapter, another letter to Poonam Chand, Sri Aurobindo focuses on what it means to do divine work. Move from being the worker into being the servant, eventually into being the conscious instrument, and finally to be the child unaware of what you are, lying on the lap of the Divine Mother and simply doing as she wills. It's a progressive ascent. So we're moving now from the internal demands to the externalities, to the execution of what a changed consciousness does. So there's an internal component to the yoga, there's an external component to the yoga. The psychological change, then typified in human life, not simply in the personal life, but in the communal life. And then we arrive at the sixth chapter, in which the four aspects are discussed. But before that, the three terms of the Divine Mother, transcendent, universal, individual, the Mahashakti, standing intermediate between that unknowable above and this triple world here, and taking those truths and massaging them into us as we permit it. So, we can see then that Sri Aurobindo meant for the first step of this yoga to psychicize the personal nature and move towards a collective harmony based upon the oneness that we would experience in the real being of the Divine Mother. We find the center of our soul and we find the center of society in her. And then when we look from soul to another, we see another soul. And we see that soul based in the conscious being of the Mahashakti, just as we are. This is the foundation of a changed society. This is the foundation of a spiritual family growing into a large collectivity. So Sri Aurobindo intended to change the conscious beings of the sadhaks present around him through her force to establish a community of spirit in Pondicherry, in what became his ashram. And then he planned to extend it throughout India, more and more extensions, chapters, miniature ashrams, intentional communities, whatever you wish to call it, would populate India, because that would become the continuation and the extension of Sanatana Dharma into a new reality. And then from there into the wider world. To materialize this, money was necessary. To materialize this, actual hard work in matter was necessary. So our first job again was individually to live from the soul and not from the ego. And then to move from the individual realization and transformation from the personal to the social. And these vehicles would have an impact upon the globe such that humanity would be drawn towards a deep psychological unity. This continues to be our aspiration. Let us not give it up. We must fulfill it. I want to say that Sri Aurobindo, from the time that he suspended his writing in Arya in 1921, wrote little for these years leading up to 1927 when he composed these chapters of the Mother. A message, several personal letters, and finally this grand closing chapter. Mellifluous, powerful. I don't think that he ever wrote more beautifully or powerfully than in these pages. This is a most wonderful and majestic work, and it can have a transformative impact on the way you think and feel and perceive the world and yourself. So there are passages of it that I would recommend that you remember deeply, especially those which call to you. You find them, you feel them, you remember them, and in moments when you need them, summon them forth. It'll help you remember what your mission is here, what your direction is, and inevitably how you will fulfill it. Let's read from Savitri. And bear with me, this is going to be a long section. This is from Book 10, The Book of the Double Twilight, Canto 4, The Dream Twilight of the Earthly Real. This begins on page 660 and runs to page 663. Thought there has revelation's sunbright eyes. The word, a mighty and inspiring voice, enters truth's inmost cabin of privacy and tears away the veil from God and life. Then stretches the boundless finite's last expanse, the cosmic empire of the overmind, time's buffer state bordering eternity, too vast for the experience of man's soul. All here gathers beneath one golden sky. The powers that build the cosmos station take in its house of infinite possibility. Each god from there builds his own nature's world. Ideas are phalanxed like a group of suns, each marshaling his company of rays. Thought crowds in masses, seized by one regard. All time is one body, space a single look. There is the Godhead's universal gaze, and there the boundaries of immortal mind. The line that parts and joins the hemispheres closes in on the labor of the gods, fencing eternity from the toil of time. In her glorious kingdom of eternal light, all ruler, ruled by none, the truth supreme, omnipotent, omniscient, and alone, in a golden country, keeps her measureless house. In its corridor, she hears the tread that comes out of the unmanifest, never to return till the unknown is known and seen by men. Above the stretch and blaze of cosmic sight, above the silence of the wordless thought, formless creator of immortal forms, nameless, investitured with the name divine, transcending time's hours, transcending timelessness, the mighty mother sits in lucent calm and holds the eternal child upon her knees, attending the day when he shall speak to fate. There is the image of our future's hope. There is the sun for which all darkness waits. There is the imperishable harmony. The world's contradictions climb to her and are one. There is the truth of which the world's truths are shreds, the light of which the world's ignorance is the shade, till truth draws back the shade that it has cast, the love our hearts call down to heal all strife, the bliss for which the world's derelict sorrows yearn. Thence comes the glory sometimes seen on earth, the visits of Godhead to the human soul, the beauty and the dream on nature's face. There the perfection born from eternity calls to it the perfection born in time, the truth of God surprising human life, the image of God overtaking finite shapes. There, in a world of everlasting light, in the realms of the immortal supermind, truth, who hides here her head in mystery, her riddle deemed by reason impossible in the stark structure of material form, unenigmaed lives. Unmasked her face, and there is nature and the common law of things. There, in a body made of spirit stuff, the hearthstone of the ever-living fire, action translates the movements of the soul. Thought steps infallible and absolute, and life is a continual worship's rite, a sacrifice of rapture to the One. A cosmic vision, a spiritual sense, feels all the infinite lodged in finite form, and seen through a quivering ecstasy of light, discovers the bright face of the bodiless, in the truth of a moment, in the moment's soul, can sip the honey wine of eternity. A spirit who is no one and innumerable, the one mystic infinite person of his world, multiplies his myriad personality, on all his bodies seals his divinity's stamp, and sits in each immortal and unique. The immobile stands behind each daily act, a background of the movement and the scene, upholding creation on its might and calm, and change on the immutable's deathless poise. The timeless looks out from the traveling hours. The ineffable puts on a robe of speech, where all its words are woven like magic threads, moving with beauty, inspiring with their gleam, and every thought takes up its destined place, recorded in the memory of the world. The truth supreme, vast and impersonal, fits faultlessly the hour and circumstance, its substance a pure gold, ever the same, but shaped into vessels for the Spirit's use, its gold becomes the wine jar and the vase. All there is a supreme epiphany. The all-wonderful makes a marvel of each event. The all-beautiful is a miracle in each shape. The all-blissful smites with rapture the heart's throbs. A pure celestial joy is the use of sense. Each being there is a member of the self, a portion of the million-thoughted all, a claimant to the timeless unity, the many's sweetness, the joy of difference, edged with the intimacy of the One. so with your permission, and we invite your participation. We move still ever towards the one next week when we take up the synthesis of yoga. First, we'll cover the introductory chapters, and we will eventually get to the yoga of divine works. Thank you for being with us on this journey through these brilliant pages of Sri Aurobindo's The Mother. Wonderful to have you with us. Namaste. Jai Ma.